Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Native Americans and Funding Dilemmas Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 18, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Salazar v. Rama Navajo Chapter. This case involves the Federal Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, which allows Native American tribes to take over the administration of various federally funded educational and social service programs and to receive full coverage for the cost of doing so. The question in this case is whether, given that Congress has capped the total amount that may be expended to cover such costs, and that the amount is inadequate to cover all tribes' costs in full, the government may simply divide the available support funds among the tribes, or must pay the support costs of each tribe in full, notwithstanding the statutory cap. To discuss the case, we have Jonathan Cohn, who is a partner at the Washington, D.C. office of Sidley Austin, LLP. As Mr. Cohn notes, he and his firm are counsel to the respondents in this case. Also, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Cohn.
Let me begin by giving a simple disclaimer. I am not the least bit impartial on this one. My firm represents the tribes, the respondents, and I help write their brief. So, needless to say, I have some definite views on how this case should come out. That said, this is a basic contract case, and it presents a fundamental question of government contracting law, namely whether the government can breach contracts without paying damages whenever a federal agency overcommits itself by signing too many contracts, which in the aggregate exceed Congress's appropriation. This is an issue that concerns virtually all government contractors and can arise in virtually any industry, but this particular case involves the Rama Navajo chapter and other tribes that entered into what are known as self-determination contracts. Pursuant to a federal statute, the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. The basic bargain under these contracts is that the tribe will administer certain federal programs, such as running a hospital or a police department or a school, and in exchange, the federal government will pay the tribes. Importantly, part of the contract price is the overhead the tribes incur in running the program, such as utilities and rent. These are called contract support costs, but to keep things simple, I'll just call them overhead. Each of the contracts specify an amount for overhead or specify a rate or methodology for determining the overhead. That's all part of the contract. For decades, however, the government has failed to pay in full. The tribes perform their end of the bargain, providing the government service, whether it's the school, the hospital, the police department, but year after year, the government paid only a portion of the contract price. Now, to be fair, the agencies signing the contracts, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service, were in a pretty tough spot. The statute that authorized the contracts did more than just authorize the contracts. It mandated the contracts. It required and still requires the agency to enter into as many of these contracts as meet the basic conditions of the statute. But at the same time, Congress did not appropriate enough money to cover all the contracts. It appropriated tens of millions of dollars every year, but that was insufficient to cover everything. So the agency's defense to not paying the contracts in full was that they simply ran out of money. Their piggy banks were empty. That same issue was resolved against the government 7 years ago in a case called Cherokee versus Levin. There, the Supreme Court held that the government must fulfill its end of the bargain, just like any other contracting party, even when it overspends and the agency has nothing left in the bank. The court indicated that the aggrieved private contractors can recover damages from the judgment fund, a separate indefinite appropriation that is for paying final judgments against the United States. In the case at hand, the government tried to distinguish Cherokee. According to the government, the big difference is this. In Cherokee, Congress had appropriated a certain amount for overhead costs and also appropriated additional unrestricted funds, which could have been used for overhead, but the agency instead chose to use for other priorities. In this case, by contrast, Congress expressly capped appropriations for overhead. In other words, for each of the fiscal years in question, Congress stated that the amount available for overhead is, quote, not to exceed, end quote, a precise dollar figure, such as $95 million. And although that amount, the $95 million, was large enough to pay any individual contract, it was insufficient to pay all the contracts with all the different tribes. The district court agreed with the government that this distinction is dispositive. The Tenth Circuit, however, reversed. As that court explained, the government's position was contradicted by over 100 years of contracting law, and the court held that even if an agency's appropriation is limited, the government is not free to breach contracts with impunity. Instead, just like in Cherokee, the aggrieved contractor can sue and recover the unpaid amount in damages from the judgment fund, regardless of the cap on the agency's own appropriation. Challenging this decision, the government sought Supreme Court review. In light of a conflict between the Tenth Circuit and the Federal Circuit, the court granted cert. Argument was held last week on April 18th, and it was fairly active, with seven justices peppering both sides with questions. The focus was a basic rule of government contracting law called the Ferris Doctrine, named after an 1892 Court of Claims case, Ferris versus United States. Under the Ferris Doctrine, the government is bound by its contractual commitments, regardless of whether Congress appropriated enough money to cover all the contracts. A government agent who overspends might run afoul of the Anti-Deficiency Act or other criminal statutes that restrict overspending, but the innocent private party is not left holding the bag. It can sue for breach of contract and recover damages in court. For 120 years, the only exception to the Ferris rule has been when Congress does not appropriate enough money to cover the particular contract at issue. In those circumstances, the contractor can easily read the appropriation statute and know whether or not it covers his contract. But whereas here the multi-million dollar appropriation exceeds by far the contract price, and the only problem is that the government has entered into too many contracts with too many different parties, the contractor can sue for breach and recover damages. There should be no question that this is the law. Indeed, even the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, which is an arm of Congress, has recognized the validity and ongoing vitality of the Ferris Rule. The GAO's authoritative summary of federal funding law, the Red Book, on which courts routinely rely, unambiguously states that, quote, it is settled that contractors paid from a general appropriation are not barred from recovering for breach of contract, even though the appropriation is exhausted, end quote. But despite all that, in this case, the Solicitor General's office has taken a different course and tried to raise a flurry of distinctions, none of which has merit. For instance, the government has asserted that Ferris did not involve a statutory cap. This point is factually wrong, as the government's Red Book acknowledges. Second, the government tried to contend an argument that Ferris is distinguishable, because here the tribes had notice that there would be a shortfall in appropriations. But putting aside the fact that this assertion is also factually incorrect, Ferris and the recent Cherokee decision make clear that private contractors are simply not charged with knowing what a government agency does with its money. The private parties are not expected to audit the government's books and determine when the government overspent. Next, the government argued that this case is different because under the relevant statute, the federal agencies were required to enter into the contracts and did not have discretion to say no. But the government never explains why this difference should allow the government to breach contracts with impunity and to shortchange the private contractors who are not at all responsible for the shortfall in appropriations. It is Congress that created the problem, and Congress can fix it. Contracting tribes should not be the ones punished for the government's fiscal mismanagement. Next, the government contended that these contracts, as well as the statute authorizing the contracts, make clear that the government's obligations are contingent on the availability of appropriations. the Solicitor General's office pointed to a clause stating that the contracts were, quote, subject to the availability of appropriations, end quote. But the problem with this argument is that in Cherokee, the Supreme Court already rejected it, and citing Ferris, explained what the clause actually means. In short, the provision makes the government's contractual obligations contingent on Congress appropriating enough money for that particular contract. But the clause does not make the obligations contingent on Congress appropriating enough money for all contracts that the agency might enter into. In other words, the provision is consistent with Ferris. It does not overrule Ferris. Finally, the government tried to insinuate a constitutional issue into the mix. According to the government, the Appropriations Clause gives Congress the power over the purse and prohibits expenditures exceeding appropriations. But this argument begs the question of what Congress actually did. And the argument overlooks the fact that Congress expressly authorized, indeed mandated, the contracts at issue, and also appropriated money for damages through the judgment fund. So this argument fails as well. As for how all this will come out, it's always hard to predict how the court's going to decide a case. Here, there appear to be three votes solidly with the tribes. Justices Scalia, Sotomayor, and Kagan were all skeptical of the government's position that it can breach these contracts with impunity. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Breyer, however, seemed to push back against the tribe's position. They seemed most persuaded by the not-to-exceed cap on appropriations, wondering what effect that cap would have if the tribe could recover damages. The other three justices were even more difficult to read. On balance, however, the tribes probably have more reason for optimism than does the government. At bottom, the government is asking for a departure from 120 years of government contracting law, and that probably will not sit well with the majority of the court, especially since to this day, the government's own Red Book still contradicts the position the government took at argument, and the relevant statute governing these contracts expressly states that any ambiguity must be construed in favor of the tribe. Also, a decision in favor of the government would likely call into question the enforceability of millions of other government contracts across a broad array of industries, as the Chamber of Commerce noted in its amicus brief. Contracts would cease being contracts in a meaningful sense. Contractors would never know what they're going to get from the government until the government decides to give it to them, and that's simply wrong and unfair. In any event, a decision is expected from the court by the end of June.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.